This is Neijing Now, prioritizing well-being.
Neijing is the vitality that shields us from disease.
Neijing Now, placing and taking responsibility for the health of the individual and the planet. From molecular biology to global ecology, from political socioeconomics to psychology and spirituality. Neijing Now, demystifying medicine, empowering host resistance. We can be found on the web at neijingnow.org, neijingnow.org. I'm Dr. Jayashree Chander, and I welcome you to another edition of Exploring Neijing Now. In this episode of Neijing Now, Dr. Bob Harrison and I discussed the relationship of TMJ disorders with the epidemic of occupational stress.
The workers' compensation system is not friendly to the idea of work-related stress.
Augusta Moore gives us the Feldenkrais perspective on the relationship of the temporomandibular joint with the rest of the body.
Well, in Feldenkrais, we're not trying to change you.
And Gaylene Newquist shares the value of hypnotherapy in addressing TMJ disorders.
In hypnotherapy, we inquire with the intention to transform, to change.
I'm speaking with Dr. Bob Harrison. He's a clinical professor of occupational and environmental medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. I'm talking to him today about temporomandibular joint disorders and the association with work-related stress. Bob, welcome to Neijing Now.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
In our previous episode of Neijing Now, we discussed temporomandibular joint disorders. We discussed the topic from the perspective of a chiropractor and the perspective of a professor of dentistry. One of the things that became very clear is that stress is a major contributing factor to temporomandibular joint disorders. And so I started thinking about the relationship between work and stress. We know that work-related stress is very common. There may be a connection between work-related stress and the development of temporomandibular joint disorders, and I wondered if you had any comments.
Work-related stress is a major problem in the workplace. We know that work-related stress increases the risk of cardiovascular, that is, heart disease, increased risk of heart attacks, increases the risk of sleep problems, a whole host of different psychological problems. And I think it certainly could contribute or cause temporomandibular joint problems.
Do you think people recognize that association between work-related stress and stress causing temporomandibular joint disorders?
First of all, I think work-related stress is not very well recognized, either by the person himself or herself. They don't think about some of the symptoms they may be having and think about how it could be caused by their work conditions or the shift work that they're doing, the work environment in general.
I think that people really do recognize that work causes them stress. And there's some surveys that were done by the American Psychological Association in 2007 and 2009 that reported pretty high numbers. 60% of workers say that work is a significant source of stress in their life, or that 40% say that they're tense or stressed during their workday, or 50% said they're less productive because of their stress, or about 50% said that they've considered or have made career decisions based on work-related stress. So I think workers do recognize it, but maybe the system doesn't recognize work-related stress or doesn't acknowledge it or want to admit it.
Yeah, I agree with you. Individuals or workers, when asked, will certainly report those problems. I don't believe that when they interact with the healthcare system, they necessarily report it to their healthcare providers about how they feel about their job and whether it could be connected to their symptoms. Their healthcare providers may also not recognize or ask.
Most physicians don't even ask what the person's occupation is, much less whether that occupation is causing that person stress.
Well, in fact, probably less than 10% of physicians ask what somebody does for a living, the exposures or hazards on the job, the shift that people work. For instance, we know that many people work night shifts or rotating shifts, and that certainly contributes to job stress, a whole host of sleep problems. So you're absolutely right. Most healthcare providers, unfortunately, don't have the awareness or the training and typically don't ask their patients.
And don't have the time in the current structure of the healthcare system where the time per visit is really getting shortened.
Yeah, the time for a visit gets shortened. The amount of information that some healthcare providers are asked to collect in a given visit, it all feels very compressed often to both the doctor and the patient.
If a physician did think about asking about workplace hazards and exposures, but then to make the next step to ask about workplace stress, productivity demands, as you mentioned, shift work, sleep cycle disruption, workplace bullying, harassment, these kinds of issues, that's like opening a can of worms. And I think most physicians would probably avoid it.
Either avoid it because it may take even more time. In addition to the factors that you mentioned, how much control somebody has over their workplace turns out to be one of the key factors in workplace stress.
And the possibilities for career growth and continued learning and what is called the effort-reward balance, all of these things play into it. Then there's the added factor of when a physician discovers that a symptom or a diagnosis might be work-related, there's more paperwork involved.
Yeah, even though the paperwork is in fact pretty simple, it's often extremely frightening to a healthcare provider. The specter of workers' compensation, reporting, attorneys entering the picture, even though actually rarely this is the case, it raises the anxiety level, and healthcare providers may just simply say, I don't want to deal with it. I'm not even going to ask about the work environment and the role that stress plays in the health conditions of the patient.
Exactly. So coming back to TMJ, temporomandibular joint disorders, in that case, I think even the patients don't necessarily recognize that this could be something that's being aggravated or being caused by the conditions at work. They would generally tend to go straight to their dentist.
Yes, I think that's correct. While that may be totally fine and appropriate, they should also share with their healthcare provider something about their work environment, stress on the job, how that might be contributing to their symptoms of TMJ. Healthcare providers should be asking about that. And if not, patients should come armed with those questions and with that information. Patients need to be advocates for themselves as well.
Exactly. Perhaps even the dental care practitioners, the level of awareness amongst that profession could be increased about the relationship between occupational stress and TMJ.
Really excellent point. My guess is that dentists receive even less training in occupational stress than physicians or other healthcare providers do.
We now have the Center for Interprofessional Education at the University of California at San Francisco, where they're really trying to basically cross-train dentists and physicians and physical therapists and basically the healthcare practitioners that are trained at UCSF to learn about each other's disciplines more so that we can improve the quality of care.
Well, let's put occupation and work into that mix. People spend at least 8 hours a day, sometimes 12 or even 16. Folks have two jobs. The physical hazards, they're often obvious or very well recognized, but cumulative injuries or stress are much less well recognized. So that dialogue is fantastic.
Yeah, exactly. I actually did approach the director of the center to offer my services. Well, he was very happy to have me involved without any pay. The usual story. You're actually a very experienced occupational medicine physician. People refer to you from all over the country. Has anybody ever come to you with complaints about TMJ and some thoughts that it might be related to their work?
I've had patients, and they will tell me that they have TMJ issues, and they'll often say, well, I'm just seeing my dentist. I need to pursue more questions in depth about the stress they have on their job.
So next time you might delve into the can of worms a little bit more.
Yes, it's an important can of worms. It needs to be more recognized by healthcare providers and also by our workers' compensation system so that if healthcare providers report those injuries, it can be seen as compensable.
Exactly. So what do you know about how workers' compensation would approach or receive a claim of TMJ related to occupational stress?
The workers' compensation system is not friendly to the idea of work-related stress in general.
Probably because there's just so much of it.
There's a lot of it. There are many, many psychological issues that can occur as a result of the workplace. There are many, many excellent studies that document that this is a major problem. The workers' compensation system, while it used to be more generous and open towards the concept of work-related stress, in the last 10 years has really cut back compensation in general. And in my experience, when work-related stress claims are filed, there's often a denial and then a lot of review, consultation, and examinations by outside doctors. And it's been a struggle.
Sort of as expected. Do you think that having more data that would show a strong association between TMJ and occupational stress, that would be helpful? I mean, I found one paper from Japan where they studied about 2,000 employees and found about 23% to have high TMJ symptoms. They found that computer use time and female gender were associated with worse TMJ symptoms. So that's the only paper I could find. I couldn't find any other papers that really put that association between jaw symptoms, oral facial pain, and work-related anything, ergonomic stress.
You're absolutely right. We need to have more data, more information about how TMJ or symptoms of TMJ also fit into the general problem of work-related stress.
Yeah, it's a big problem and it's a common problem and it can be a disabling problem. I mean, if your jaw is not working and it hurts to eat, that's a big problem.
It certainly can be. For some patients, it's not a trivial issue. Many healthcare providers might just dismiss it as a minor nagging but livable complaint. But for some patients, it can really be troubling.
Oh, yeah. You can wake up with headaches. You can grind down your teeth. You can need tens of thousands of dollars of orthodontic work or orthopedic work. It's not trivial, as you say.
Yes, that's right.
Is there anything else you'd like to add about TMJ, workers' comp, occupational stress?
Bring these problems to the attention of your healthcare provider, including information about your job.
And is there any more effective way to approach the workers' comp system when it comes to issues related to occupational stress or bringing up TMJ as a compensable injury?
That's a really good question.
I wonder if clinicians or even patients could remind clinicians to fill out a doctor's first report of occupational injury when they are addressing a case of TMJ.
I think it'd be important for someone with TMJ or another work-related stress problem to see a healthcare provider who's familiar with the workers' compensation system, knows how to file a doctor's first report, which initiates, establishes a claim for a work-related problem, and then can follow up with the necessary documentation.
Yeah, exactly. It's been great talking to you, Dr. Harrison. Thank you for taking the time.
Thanks so much.
That was Dr. Bob Harrison from the University of California, San Francisco. I'm speaking with Augusta Moore. She's a certified Feldenkrais practitioner with a private practice, specializing in dancers, actors, musicians, and people from all walks of life. She also teaches at the Oberlin Dance Collective in San Francisco. She's got over 30 years of experience in the dance community. Augusta, welcome to Neijing Now.
Why, thank you. It's great to be here.
Great to be talking to you. You know, I've been taking Feldenkrais class with you for years now, and I always benefit after every class. I'm so pleased that you're here to inform our listeners about what Feldenkrais is. We're discussing oral health these days, and if you could tell us about the jaw, clenching of the jaw and grinding of the jaw. First of all, let me ask you to explain a little bit about what Feldenkrais is.
I think I'll try to explain the two at the same time, to say that as a Feldenkrais practitioner, it's very difficult for me to look at a jaw I have to look at a person, and then from there, I can maybe see why they're having something going on with their jaw. The Feldenkrais method, and on many somatic methods, we don't have a protocol for how to treat TMJ. We look at a person, well, maybe they're a little anxious, and so that might cause them to grind a bit. There might be something going on with some sense of balance, and that could be coming from the head or from the feet, anywhere between the head and the feet, that's causing them to lean to one side or the other, which could pull the jaw over to one side a little bit. There might be a traumatic history involved in it, or even just a surgery, you know, not necessarily emotionally traumatic. It could be the way they hang the bag off their shoulder that causes the jaw to work in balance. The jaw, as we know, is the strongest muscle. I think I just heard something recently, too, that when a human being is starving, the jaw is the last bone to go into atrophy. It hangs on, I guess is what I'm trying to say. So I would be interested to know why this person needs to hang on. The Feldenkrais method is looking at habitual patterns and then see if there's something can replace it. Not just the muscularity, but you're really looking at the nervous system. Why does this person need to do this? What compels them?
Can you explain a little bit how Feldenkrais actually makes that kind of an assessment to look at the jaw within the person? How do you actually do that?
Well, we are very interested in the range of function. You would do small circles with the jaw as if you perhaps had a small phonograph needle off the edge of your jaw. And you went slightly forward, slightly back, slightly forward. You would do this and keep reducing the size of it because we're not looking for range of motion so much, but range of function. And the smaller it is, the more you can appreciate the slight nuance difference between right and left. Suppose a person very slightly takes their lower jaw to the left. When I'm teaching this, I have people bite down, but then slightly take the lower jaw to the left, so it's not dramatically over to the left, but just a little bit so you could still eat, but it's just slightly over.
I'm trying it right now.
Go ahead. You'll feel, and you just bite, and then just relax and see how that is. And now you go slightly to the right. Oh, my God. We never say bad. We say, you know, which option do you want? So is that more difficult for you? Go back to the middle and go slightly to the left again. Go even more slightly. Go so that people looking could not tell that you were going. Do it so you can almost not tell. You're hiding it from yourself that you take your jaw to the left. That's right. And you bite a few times. Yeah. Good. And then rest. And then take your jaw slightly to the other direction. Can you feel that's much more subtle? And then rest for a moment. This is kind of fun. This is a very specific Feldenkrais way to deal with it. And then we would look at it forward and back a little bit, the jaw sliding slightly forward, as if you had a slight underbite. And you start to notice a difference on the pull on the right side or the left side of your throat, or maybe the muscles of the tongue. The tightness in your tongue or your neck, of course, will affect how your jaw is pulling. After we've gone forward and back, we've gone right and left, we'll connect it in a circle. So we would see forward and back is sort of 6 and 12 on a clock, and the right and left is 9 o'clock and 3 o'clock. And we would then, with this jaw movement, taking the jaw slightly forward to 12, slightly over to 3, and then back to 6, and then over to 9. And you try to make it as small as possible, so you were really making a circle, not a Salvador Dali type creation.
I remember doing this in a workshop with you with my sacrum, and it was absolutely revolutionary for me. It changed my whole life. I'd never even thought to do the same kind of clock with my jaw. This could change my life as well.
The pelvic clock is a classic Feldenkrais lesson. What would be really fun with the jaw is to now go through the 1 o'clock, the 2, you know, find each number. One of the greatest revelations in my Feldenkrais life was finding the number 7. In my pelvic clock, and then I could do a triple attitude turn in ballet class, and that was the significance for me.
Wow, a triple attitude turn.
It was really great. It really is revolutionary. And then the circle, we'd reverse it, and we might look at the quadrants. What is the 12 to 3 like? And kind of try to clean that up, and then what is the 3 to 6 like? This sense of circle could be done on almost any part of the body, and I'm constantly reinventing that. I'm circling so many things in my body that I hadn't before, but the Feldenkrais accuracy of the clock is what makes it so great. the beauty of the Feldenkrais movements is they constrain you so you can't compensate. It's a revelation because we work so hard to compensate.
It requires a lot of concentration, and the movements are really subtle. And you do see where you skip through areas and you use other parts of your body to make that part of your body move. So it is really revelatory as well as being revolutionary.
A lot of times the jaw is the only part of the head people feel. A lot of times people don't have any sense of the top of their head. Anything above the eyes is not noticed. But if I was working with you right now, for instance, I'd probably look and doing some eye movements, perhaps some kind of eye clocks, anything to give sensation to other parts of the head. So there's kind of a pseudo headstand that we do where you can put a clock on the top of your head and you do 6, 12, 9, 3. There's a Feldenkrais lesson where you paint your head.
You're not actually painting your head.
No, you're imaginarily painting your head, though sometimes people will take their hand, and I encourage that if they can't feel it. The reason is that it brings the nerve endings. It literally brings life to them as they reach out to touch this paintbrush. A lot of times when people paint their head, they realize that they have a really strange shaped head, not by the way it looks in the mirror, but the way that they really feel it on a somatic basis. So it feels like there's a bite out of it, or you feel like Gumby. Funny stuff.
Yeah, I know. I feel like one side of my cranium is offset from the other side of my cranium. One is a little higher than the other.
The Gumby head.
Yeah, if I were to stand on my head, then one side would just be a little bit...
You'd need a lift on that side. It's a fantastic observation. I worked with a man who, he was a yoga student, and his yoga teacher kept correcting his headstand because his legs would bend over to one side, but she kept correcting him by pulling the legs, but the problem was in his rib cage and neck. So she was actually creating another twist.
So that brings up a good point. What is the difference between Feldenkrais and yoga?
We'll say Feldenkrais is a neuromuscular reeducation, so that you're dealing with habitual patterns. It's used a lot in physical therapy. A lot of work is being done with special ed with children. You're really trying to help someone get a better sense of their full body. That's really what it is. You're bringing life to all the different parts. A lot of other somatic modalities are also interested in this. So I think what is unique about Feldenkrais is partly these circular movements. Feldenkrais recorded over 600 lessons. And what these ATM lessons are ingenious, novel movements that Moshe Feldenkrais invented. But he began working with them when he was laid up in bed for 9 months with a knee injury. So he decided to lie in bed and just see if he could save his knee. And so he worked out all these ingenious ways of, I say they're ingenious because they're so novel. You do funny things, you're lying on your back and you lift your leg this way and you turn your head that way and your eyes go the opposite way and you're doing these, and they're very gentle movements, most of them. Although because he was a martial artist, they could get very athletic, but you're encouraged and really expected to never do anything that would hurt you. Just being asked to do these things and working them through your nervous system starts to help you construct how to do it in your mind, in your body. I see Feldenkrais ATM in 3 steps. I have 1, the desire to do this movement. The teacher gives an instruction. And step 3 is the full physical embodied movement, seeing someone move through space. But number 2 is the part that often interests me, is the part where you're organizing internally. It's that you can see somebody, they're not asleep, and they're not moving, but they're enlivening in some way. And that is the nervous system organizing before it goes into a bigger movement. And that's the place where a lot of people need to spend more time so they don't hurt themselves. They don't just go into the pattern. That was long.
That was beautiful also. You know what? It reminds me a lot about Vipassana meditation, which is also kind of an internal investigation of your experience of any given moment. Perhaps the difference being that in Vipassana meditation, you are not attempting to change anything or to do anything, whereas in Feldenkrais, there is some instruction to find a subtle movement or something like that. It also reminds me of a yoga practice too, where you're investigating how the particular bone or muscle is moving in a certain way or aligning in a certain way, but there is a difference.
It'll be hard for me to answer because I'm really not a yoga expert. I don't study yoga that much, so I can't really say. I know that those ATM instructions can make people feel a little oppressed and feel like they have to do them. even though we have a room full of adults, there's a lot of training and people want to produce this movement because a teacher is telling them to do it. And this is part of the wonderful study, is your social obligation to do what people are telling you to do and still try to find yourself. I mean, this is the part that interests me. So the instructions are meant to be ignored as soon as possible, if necessary.
That doesn't make any sense to most of us.
I know. So we try to use language more and notice how it is. How is it when you do this? I have a number of students who will come and take a nap for 45 minutes. And then in the last 5 minutes, they'll move a little bit. Some of them will get up and do the whole movement. But they're really taking time to organize. What I really think is going on is most people are not, they haven't had a chance to go to neutral before. So they come in, set in a particular motion. Say, for instance, you always carry your bag on your right arm, so your right shoulder's up. Or you wore an eye patch on your eye 5 years ago, and so now your neck is just slightly turned to look out of that eye. Many things like that. You had a sore tooth, and so now you just eat on one side. I had an oral surgery when I was 14, only ate on one side for 25 years because of it. And it was fine. There was no reason. There was no problem. This was simply a slight memory of this injury. The habit, the incident of that was so strong that I didn't eat on that side of my mouth for 25 years. That's how we are, is that we are wired to save our lives. And so if it's okay now, we don't just let go of that. You need those habits. That's why we always really respect how they come. We just come as we are. You're perfect as you are. When Feldenkrais, we're not trying to change you. The Feldenkrais movements, they'll often, you know, end up in roles and things like that, and people enjoy that. So that's the thing, is that it's really because they look so fun that people want to do them, and rightly so, and sometimes that's the right thing to do.
But I think they're primarily just functional, right? I mean, it's kind of like a way to teach you how to function differently.
Yeah. I mean, it's developmental. In the training, you're actually going through prenatal. You're starting in more flexed positions, and then you're going into extended positions, side bending. So you're learning spinal movements. This is when you learn Feldenkrais, as if you're going to be a practitioner. And as a teacher, I go through kind of a series like this. I'll go through, oh, it's time to go back to spinal movements. Then we'll go and we'll start adding limbs to it, and we'll start adding oral, mouth, tongue movements to it. You know, you're building up the body. What was your question?
I was just seeing the similarity between yoga and meditation and Feldenkrais in the investigative nature of, you know, investigating yourself.
Yeah. We're not trying to change people per se. We're trying to help them become aware of what they do so they can make a decision about how they want to be. What would I change them to? It's not for me to make a decision about how someone should be. All I do is give them contrasts. So you feel, how is it on the right? How is it on the left? What is it like up in the shoulder compared to the hip? And, you know, you go through these comparisons, and then this gives you a chance to see potential. And this is what happens when something gets hurt. So say for some reason, this is going back to the toothache, if your jaw hurts, you make it disappear, or you'll make some part of it disappear.
Metaphorically speaking.
Yeah. Well, even in your function, you're just sort of ignoring it. So it might actually be sort of hanging. How can I describe it? Like a shutter hanging off your window. So it's not a functional part of your house anymore. You know, we have this saying that if it's not helping, it's probably hurting. In a boat, if something's hanging off, it's just dead weight. So it's better if it's integrated. You invite it back into your body. So that's why the painting the head, the doing the circles, all of these things are ways to help you realize that this part has been lost from your consciousness or asleep due to whatever reason, exhaustion, trauma, pain. At one point in my practice, everybody had some kind of low disc problem, had some kind of toe injury within a year and a half of that. And then after a year, one person came in who that wasn't true. But it was amazing that everybody, and I said, did you ever, oh yeah, I really stubbed my toe badly. So they held their foot in this way, that held their hip in a way. Their low back wasn't moving properly anymore. This is the kind of thing why, you know, somatic practice is so interesting.
Once again, it just reminds me of really awakening your awareness in every part of your body. You know, whether you do it through Feldenkrais or through meditation or through yoga, they're all different approaches to the same awakening.
It's totally true. I have so much respect for everybody's practice. And, you know, the bigger your picture, the better off you'll be.
Yeah, and even using multiple modalities, a valid way to approach it. My experience of Feldenkrais has been that it is a meditation practice using movement.
With Feldenkrais, I can use the principle of these circles in any method. So you could certainly use that when you're at the grocery store. How did I reach for this? What is the femur bone doing? What is this? What is the spiral of that? I mean, that's how you learn to be more comfortable, or, you know, to get what you want out of your body, to get what you want out of life. But in a really small way, say, for instance, I'm doing the clock and I do 1, 2, 3 and I can't find it. So I go back to 2 and I live in 2. I don't keep pushing at 3. You don't hit your threshold and stress yourself out. You go back so that you're in a comfortable way. I think that's a really important aspect, and that you can really use that in anything.
That's very nice too, to stay comfortable as you practice. That's a very important principle.
I was a professional dancer in the San Francisco Ballet, and the last year of my career, I spent almost all the time on the physical therapy table, just the compiling of injuries. You know, you get one injury and it never really gets addressed because you just compensate enough to get back on stage, and that goes on for a while. That's what shortens people's careers. It's my whole reason for the way I work, is to try to keep that from happening for people, but it's beyond dancers now, but it's for dancers too. The most profound thing for me is that it made me feel more creative. The best writing I ever did was after I was lying in bed one Sunday working on an ATM for 3 hours, and I kind of went into some deep space, and that's when I really started sculpting, and it just broadened my options.
Nice, very nice. Congratulations. These jaw clocks that you gave us, or the eye clocks, or the skull clocks, or I don't know if there's a nose clock. Is this something you can do at home on your own?
There's a Feldenkrais book, TMJ Health, by Mark Reese, R-E-E-S-E. It was a very simple book for the general public, and there's also a tape for it. For instance, my TMJ problems were from neck surgery from cancer. I have to say that the basic medical world didn't have any acceptance of that my neck surgery would have an effect on my jaw. Unbelievably, that was not an accepted byproduct of the problem. So I wasn't given any physical therapy or anything for it, which was fine. But, you know, it's just kind of no-brainer. But, you know, things like limping pulls people's jaw to the side. I mean, the jaw, you know, it's a place that you can articulate to the right or to the left. So you could use it as a balance. If there's not so much weight on your left foot, and then you're leaning a little bit, and then your spine is curving, and you might use your jaw as a counterbalance.
I never thought of that. That is brilliant.
Thank you.
I'm imagining that it could also work in reverse, that if you tend to clench your jaw on one side, that might actually have repercussions all the way down your spine to your...
Of course, yeah. This is the surprising thing about Feldenkrais. You don't know what is going to help someone sometimes, because you'll go and work with their little toe and their neck stops hurting. I try to just sit with a person and be with them and see what I notice. It's really all I can do. My worst work with people is when I think, oh, what should I give this person who has TMJ? If I come in with that attitude, it will not usually be good, because I'm not really looking at them and I'm using something that has been done for someone else. I just need to come in and be with them.
That is incredibly beautiful, and really, it's so different than many approaches to healing and caring for people. So that is really incredible.
Just to be fair to doctors at Kaiser who have 5 minutes with their patient, you know, I don't know how I would do that so well in 5 minutes.
I think doctors used to be involved in people's lives and used to pay house calls and know the family and know the functioning of people in their community. As the business aspect of medicine has changed dramatically, it has become more of this. It's more removed and more abstract. Augusta, it's been really great talking to you. It's been really informative and inspiring, and I really thank you for your time.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
That was Augusta Moore, certified Feldenkrais practitioner in San Francisco, California. I'm speaking with Gaylene Newquist. She's a licensed psychotherapist with a master's degree in social welfare. She's also a certified hypnotherapist. She's worked for many years with people experiencing life-threatening illnesses, bereavement, and trauma. Gaylene, it's a real pleasure to be talking to you. Welcome to Naging Now.
Oh, thank you so much.
Gaylene, you are a multifaceted healer. Would you be willing to tell us all the modalities that you employ?
Sure. I have an MSW from UC Berkeley, a master's in social work, and from that I got a licensed clinical social work degree, which means I'm a psychotherapist. And from there I studied some things like hypnotherapy and EMDR, eye movement, desensitization, reprogramming, what a word, huh? Anyway, that's a trauma treatment that's well esteemed, and other things. I also do some hospice work.
Wow, so that's a lot of qualifications and a lot of important work that you're doing.
Thank you. You know, I was in grad school, I was getting a PhD, and it was 1992 and AIDS was happening without any antiretrovirals. And so I left and went out there and I learned a lot from the people who were dying about compassion and love and about healing. And so I think I wanted to help them find a way into their own healing when they felt blocked. So therefore, working with EMDR and hypnotherapy and so on.
Beautiful. That is just absolutely beautiful. In this series, we're focusing on oral health. And for today's episode, I want to talk about bruxism, clenching of the jaw and grinding of the teeth, and how hypnotherapy might be useful in helping us.
I think it's really a beautiful modality for this and a fun one. You know, I think people come and they're just beside themselves. They don't really know what to do. And hypnotherapy can really help you find your own answers very easily if it's something that's not physiologic. So, of course, we're going to take some sort of background, make sure that there's no dental work that's kind of misshapen or other jaw issues that are awry. But other than that, we find that stress and trauma are the two contributors. That's just something we can so easily work with in hypnotherapy, and it really can be fun. When I'm going to my own healing, hypnotherapy is my modality of preference because it's so relaxing. People leave so at peace.
Wow. Okay, so you mentioned that first you rule out any structural problems.
Yes. And so usually people, by the time they've come to me, have done that. But then we find there's so many other contributors that are more subtle, maybe multifactorial. Maybe there is something going on with dental work and so on that you fixed, and that there's still maybe some other factors also that we're needing to work with.
How do people come to hypnotherapy?
I think it's really word of mouth. You know, the whole trend of mindfulness now is very important and popular, and neuroscience is showing us how much our minds are able to work with us and to help us. And also through meditation and hypnotherapy, we can also see how much our minds can block things. And so I think the medical community, at least in Northern California, is very helpful to clients in referring them to other modalities when they feel like they've hit maybe a block or that maybe something more can be done. Maybe they're getting some relief with the devices they're wearing at night or the dental work or massage, but perhaps they could find even more benefit. And I find that that's true.
So you are finding that actually dentists and allopathic doctors are referring people with bruxism to you for hypnotherapy to address the clenching of their jaws.
Yes, some of them do. You know, I'm certainly not saying all of them do, but yes, it's happening.
That's great. That's really great. And do you find that their illness insurance, or what we call health insurance, actually covers the costs of hypnotherapy?
No, the answer is no. However, sometimes when I'm doing my assessment, maybe we'll just do a quick session of hypnotherapy to begin, and the wisdom of the mind will take you immediately to something that's obvious and perhaps something surprising for you, something you forgot, perhaps even a trauma. And in that case, since I'm a licensed psychotherapist, I may be able to bill as a psychotherapy session, but generally people who don't have a psychotherapy license, they are not going to be billing for hypnotherapy.
Are most hypnotherapists licensed psychotherapists?
No, they are not. And that's just fine. You know, we have so many beautiful, talented hypnotherapists, particularly in the Bay Area. I went to HTI Hypnotherapy Institute in Marin, and they're very skillful. If you feel like you have a trauma related to the TMJ, I would go to a licensed psychotherapist.
You mentioned stress. You mentioned trauma as major contributing factors.
Yes, and no one wants to admit either that they're stressed or they're traumatized. We do, in fact, find that all of us, let's face it, all of us have to face this mind of ours that goes on and on and on, telling us day and night how we're not doing things right and so on. That in itself is stressful. With hypnotherapy, it's kind of like I'm the tour guide that helps you go into that place that you may be familiar with when you've had some meditative experiences. It's a vast place of incredible wisdom and healing that all of us underestimate, really all of us, even the healers, underestimate. I don't think any of us completely appreciate how much brilliance lies there. I feel humbled by the people who have had to heal from the bereavement, the kinds of multiple loss bereavement I've seen. And what I learned from them is that the best thing I can do for people is help them go to their wisdom so that they can tell me what they need. But what they need from me is to get below the barrier. And so we go below the barrier. And then we go, oh, I remember this place. It's the wise place where there aren't very many obstacles. Things are very clear. Just like in meditation, there's an alert clarity. The more you focus your mind, the more relaxed your body becomes. And it's this incredible synergy of healing. But then you need a wise advisor, someone with a lot of experience, to help you inquire. Now, in meditation, usually we just notice. But in hypnotherapy, we inquire with the intention to transform, to change. That's the difference between meditation and hypnotherapy, which is lovely. Because we're going because something is off. Something is in its unnatural state. So the most important thing I can say about hypnotherapy is enjoy your guide, enjoy the ride, but also come willing. Because if you're not willing, it's not going to happen.
Well, exactly. I mean, I can imagine that the barriers that we set up actually have served us in allowing us to feel safe, allowing us to function in the world. So it might be actually really quite scary to try to go underneath the barriers and obstacles or behind or beyond or whatever. You might not actually want to go there.
Oh, that's a great question. And the answer is at the beginning, I get to know you. And I also, first of all, prepare myself if you know that there are some barriers, because we don't want to just push barriers over. We want to really respect them because they are beloved barriers that are trying to keep you safe indeed. And some of them are a little bit maladaptive at this point. So we do some exercises first. We find a safe place before we really begin. Lest you think that this sounds like it's going to go on and on, these things don't have to take a long time. You know, we can do that for one or two sessions. Sometimes one more session doing the actual work can really radically help things. Not always, you know, sometimes 6 to 12 sessions, but this is not 10 years of psychotherapy. We have the wisdom in us. We're just maybe not even taking the time to ask. And sometimes these are just habits. Sometimes this isn't a big bad trauma or a terrible thing that's going to appear. Many times we've learned bad habits from who? From our society and our parents. And we just have to be encouraged to think a little more creatively about what would be a more interesting or more helpful habit.
Beautiful. Yeah, exactly. In relation to clenching of the jaw and grinding of the teeth, are there specific kinds of things that you've seen, like as a pattern of, like, it's anger or frustration? I mean, that's what I would imagine when you're clenching your teeth and grinding your teeth, it's because you're pissed. But I'm just wondering what your experience has been.
Yeah, I can't say that I know the scientific data on this one, but experientially, yes, anger, for sure.
Anger comes in different flavors, right? Irritation, frustration, are variations on the theme of anger.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes the deep, steaming, seething kind that doesn't feel like it has a place to be let out. The jaw will do a lot of that work. If you look at the jaw is right around the throat chakra, the voice, the expression, and it's also where inhalation and exhalation happen. the absolute life force of all of us. The good news about treating this is you have the life force passing right by the jaw all the time. And I find that it's the best healer. What I do when I'm exploring in hypnotherapy, maybe what went wrong or what the unnaturalness or imbalance is that the breath is right there to be one of the healing aspects. It's so easy to use.
Beautiful. I never thought of that, the breath. In association with the jaw, and just visualize the breath passing past the jaw and through the jaw.
Absolutely. In fact, I'm thinking of a woman I did one session with. It was some version of that. Now, this is not a one-size-fits-all thing. The thing about hypnotherapy that is so luscious, besides just the physical sensation of being so relaxed, is that it is a practice of interbeing between me and you and your wise voice. And so it's always different. It's amazing. Someone might feel they need cool pouring in there to get back to balance. Someone might need to feel like they have to go sideways movements or something. But this person really benefited. She had other tight psychosomatic complaints sometime down the line. So, which I can just recommend right now, everyone could use 8 weeks of learning how to do basic non-religious meditation. In her case, it really helped her jaw, and her jaw would pop, and, you know, at times it would go out of joint, and, you know, and that didn't happen after the practice of the breath.
Wow, that's incredible. That inspires hope.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially with people who've had so much pain. And, you know, the thing about hypnotherapy is if our conscious minds could have already figured it out, it would have, because they've put their minds on this probably a long time if you've had pain for a long time. And so we just simply go to the place where the problem's hanging out, which is a little bit under the surface. And we go there and ask under there and do it in a very safe way, gentle way. And by the way, I think people have some fears about hypnotherapy that the therapist might make them do or say something that they wouldn't naturally do. And that's never the case. I'm always going to be absolutely aligning with your highest wisdom. I'm not supplanting anything in you with something of mine. You know, when you think about hypnotists on stages and so on, extroverts volunteer for that. So that's a whole other thing. This therapy is very sacred and very much a collaboration.
I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, I have also been told, don't just let anybody do hypnotherapy on you. You have to be very careful.
Oh, I'm so glad you're asking that. That wisdom place is very wise. It will not do anything that you do not want it to do. So then someone will say, well, why did that lady bark like a dog on the stage? Well, she was a goofing around extrovert. That's why she raised her hand to go be on stage at in a hypnotherapist, you know, a circus. In hypnotherapy, it's all a collaboration about inquiring what is from your highest sense of being and well-being. All hypnotherapy is focused attention, alert, focused, relaxed attention. It's kind of like we're combing out all that fuzzy noise from your conscious mind, just combing it aside to just let yourself for a moment bask in your own knowingness without all of that self-criticism all the time, which confuses us. And then we are immobilized. And hypnotherapy can really free us to just go, oh, yeah, of course. Of course, obvious things appear in this work.
What I'm hearing you say is that you're focusing the mind in order to quiet the conscious part of the mind.
Yes.
So that you can access some part of the subconscious part of the mind.
So those would be words that a hypnotherapist would use, a conscious mind and the subconscious mind. You know, neuroscientists might use other words. A Buddhist might say we're maybe going toward the unconditioned mind, the vastness even. Where it is we're going, we probably all get a sense of where we're going. We're going to that kind of more still place that has a seat in oneself. We all have that dignified place that's always trying to give us advice and cues, but we are ramped up at a pretty quick pace right now. And I find with the technological age, you know, these things like TMJ, these are not uncommon for all of us.
So the interesting thing about TMJ and bruxism, often it manifests while we're asleep. When we're asleep, actually, the conscious part of the mind is asleep, and it is the subconscious mind that's ruling. So that makes me think that actually using hypnotherapy would be a really great modality.
Absolutely.
To access what it is that is causing the problem, and also a great way to heal the problem.
Absolutely. You just said it. That's absolutely it.
I mean, there are some people who I see clenching their jaw and grinding their jaw during the daytime as well.
Yes, and their level of awareness is not very high. And so any awareness practice is going to help, but this is very targeted awareness of what's happening in your jaw here and now. And so what I think is really amazing about hypnotherapy is if, let's say, there was a particular trauma, you can go there if we chose to, if that was what we wanted to do, and be in a here and now situation from a moment in the past or even in a moment in the future where you're relieved of this feeling. And so it's like you get to be in a now, but you get to decide which now you want to be in.
So you still have control over yourself.
Absolutely you do. Absolutely you do. And in fact, part of the inquiry is verbal. And then the other thing that's amazing about hypnotherapy is if you don't feel like using your voice, or if there's something that we just really feel like the voice isn't even, it's still kind of overthinking, we can give you signals with your fingers. And I have seen the most extraordinary things revealed by just letting your fingers talk. Right thumb, yes. Left thumb, no. Yep, 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 no. The body knows and it's trying to tell us.
That's so hopeful. So how does one actually go about choosing a hypnotherapist?
The thing that's true of therapists is also true of hypnotherapists, that there's a big feeling of intuition. For me, I would try to consider the credentials and where they got the credentials. Probably, again, if you think there's any trauma that might be there, then a licensed psychotherapist and a hypnotherapist would be better, even more so than a psychotherapist. With the hypnotherapist, you know, you'll be cozy and you'll be closing your eyes and you'll be getting so relaxed. So you want someone who's relaxing. And that's a different quality for different people.
I appreciate that you're bringing up the credentials and the gut feeling that you have about somebody. Within any healing modality, whether it's Western medicine or chiropractic or acupuncture or psychotherapy or hypnotherapy or whatever it is, not all practitioners are born equal. Like, one doctor is not the same as another doctor, and one hypnotherapist is not the same as another hypnotherapist. Asking around to your friends and getting a personal referral, that's a way that I've resorted to choosing almost anybody that I need service from, whether it's a plumber or a carpenter or a healer.
I agree.
So is there a little mini 1 minute hypnotherapy thing you could do for us?
Perhaps. Let's see what comes. Just sit up straight with your feet on the floor and feel the bottoms of your feet beginning, even as my voice goes slower and more relaxed, for you to become deeper and deeper relaxed and to feel your feet just beginning to be more and more soft and flattened on the floor. And as you find that your feet are flattening on the floor, your entire body begins to relax. And then you bring your attention to the jaw, just noticing that jaw, all of the work that it does for you every day, appreciating how all that you consume to completely sustain your body moves through the movement of the jaw, appreciating the jaw. And just noticing the places the jaw may feel right. And then noticing on the edges where the jaw does not feel right, that there's something unnatural. And even as I say this, you notice that your body is correcting so that the jaw begins to realign back into its naturalness. Just as perhaps as if you were a newborn baby. No holding, more and more relaxed. And then with every breath, beginning to turn your focus to the breath as it comes in through slightly parted lips, just begin to allow yourself to inhale some healing directly into all of those wonderful muscles around the jaw. And as you exhale, just allowing yourself to release anything that's no longer needed. That's it, noticing yourself, just moving with the flow of the breath that's already begun to heal your jaw, helping it to shift back safely and subtly back into its state of naturalness. Every inhalation, coaxing it back right into the place, just like when you were a baby, at ease and relax. And exhaling any residue of anything that's no longer needed. And enjoying the sense of peace throughout the day, even when you're not consciously aware of the breathing, you may be surprised at how the breathing continues to do its healing service for you and your jaw.
Beautiful. Thank you so much.
Very nice talking to you.
It's been a real honor and a pleasure. I'm completely inspired, and thank you so much for offering yourself to us.
Really my pleasure. Thank you for asking.
That was Gaylee Newquist, licensed psychotherapist, certified hypnotherapist from San Francisco, California. Our concluding poem. My daddy, he gave me a rupee to not act like a groupie, but I was too groovy, so instead I bought some bubblegum, peppermint, spearmint, cinnamon, bubble mint, winter mint, cinnamon, and sweet mint. My auntie, she gave me a pasa to prune the acacia, but I was in Malaysia, so instead I bought some bubblegum, tropical, strawberry, banana, apple, watermelon, coconut, pineapple, tangerine, and mango. My uncle, he gave me an anna to go kiss my grandma, but she was scolding grandpa, so instead I bought some bubblegum, raspberry, almond, vanilla, lemon, cherry, grape, peach, orange, and berry. My mama, she squeezed me with a hug, 'cause I'm as cute as a bug, so I chewed and blew a bubble as big as the Hubble. Lemon lime, cotton candy, fruit punch, sour apple, juicy fruit, cola, and original.
Nanjing Now was written, edited, recorded, and produced by Dr. Jayashree Chander.
Website by Takahiro Noguchi.
Tabla and manjira played by J.C. Compositions from Pandit Swapan Chaudhary. Bass guitar by Pedro Ordonez. Drum set by G.C. Garcia.
Multi-instrumentalist Dave Rosenfeld.
Concluding poem written by J.C. Distributed by Gypsy Jace Productions. Found at gypsyjace.net. JYPSYJAYS.net. You can find us on the web at neijingnow.org. NEIJINGNOW.ORG.
Nanjing Now is an entirely listener-supported endeavor. Please donate generously if these shows are beneficial and enjoyable. Your support is essential to keep this program alive.